Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Utah unions will attempt to repeal House Bill 267 ban on a collective bargaining for public workers. They used to run Utah's national parks. They say President Trump's mass firings are a really big deal. Doge is canceling office leases across Utah. Here's where. And Heber City wants to reimagine itself, like Vernal once did, to welcome tourists. Locals asked, what about us? Joining us today are Salt Lake Tribune Open Lands reporter Anastasia Huffam. Anastasia, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Emerging News reporter Brock Marchant is with us as well. Thank you, Brock.
Thank you.
And hopefully here soon, Robert Gerke, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, to tell us about the legislature. I don't have Robert yet, so let me turn to Anastasia. Let's talk first about Doge. So this is, you know, we've been hearing this in the national news. This is the agency, the non-congressional authorized agency, which is headed by Elon Musk, right? So they're trying to look for government efficiencies to cuts in the federal government, and they're operating in Utah as well, sounds like.
Yes, they are. We saw on the newly created Department of Government Efficiency website, which, as you said, is headed by Elon Musk, reported that it wants to, or has actually terminated 10 office space leases used by federal agencies in Utah. And this information is as of March 2nd. The website is updating sporadically. And it's also worth noting that the New York Times has reported some inconsistencies and inaccuracies in what the department's website has reported about its lease cancellations and the grants it's terminated. So, you know, it's definitely with a grain of salt, but this is what the Department of Government Efficiency is reporting as of earlier this week.
What do they say? How much money do they think they've saved here?
So the department estimates the value of the 10 leases that they've terminated in Utah to be over $1.2 million. Which, you know, is definitely money, but it's not, you know, an overwhelming amount of money. And, you know, these leases include office spaces for, you know, really runs the gamut of different federal agencies, from the Food and Drug Administration to the National Park Service to the Army Corps of Engineers.
Various cities across Utah, I guess, would be affected. These office spaces are in place, I guess, from Logan to St. George.
Yeah, we've got a lot of geographical diversity. There's four office spaces in Salt Lake City that will be terminated, or the leases will be terminated for those. There's also an office in Bountiful, West Valley City, Moab, Monticello, and as you mentioned, Logan and St. George. So yeah, it really is, they're spanning the whole state.
Well, that's, I guess these cuts are affecting everywhere, including here in Utah. Several other stories, by the way, on the effects of these cuts at sltrib.com. Anastasia, thanks so much for telling us about this.
Yeah, of course.
We're joined now by Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Hey, glad to be here, Tom. Sorry, I'm running a bit late.
Well, it's a busy, busy time and a busy, busy day. Thanks for the last day of the legislature. Thanks for coming on with us. Many stories here from you, Robert. I'd like to start with the House Bill 267, the ban on collective bargaining. That bill has passed, been signed by the governor. But unions and others who do not support this ban are, I guess, planning to take some action. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so under Utah law, anybody who opposes a bill that the legislature passes, as long as it doesn't pass by two-thirds, can file a referendum, which is basically a ballot initiative. They go out and collect signatures. If they get enough signatures, it goes on the ballot, and it would go, in this case, on the ballot in 2026. And if a majority of voters in the state want to have it repealed, it gets repealed. In the meantime, once they get the signature threshold, the bill's put on hold until the election in 2026. So that's what the UEA, the AFL-CIO, all the labor groups that were opposed to this 267 ban on collective bargaining are going to be doing. They hit a bit of a snag when they tried to file it earlier this week because the LG's interpretation of the law, and it from my perspective seems correct, is that they have to wait until after the session is over because conceivably, I guess the legislature could still change the law or whatever. So they are going to refile it on Saturday morning, and then start gathering signatures to try to get this repeal on the ballot in 2026.
Utah, as you know, the story has, I think, the most difficult referendum process. What are the requirements again?
Yeah, so in terms of the number of signatures you need, the number that, it's 140,000 and change basically right now in this state. 8%, that number is 8% of all the registered voters in the state. And you can't just get them, say, like in Salt Lake County and Utah County or something like that. You gotta get them in 15 of the 29 counties. There's that same 8% threshold broken down by county. So it's a real challenge. And then the opponents of it also get to go back and try to get signatures, get people to withdraw their signatures from the referendum packet. So you actually end up needing probably closer to 170,000 plus once, and those are valid signatures, right? As we talked about with the candidate signature process, sometimes signatures get bounced out because they, clerks decide they don't match or whatever, or the person's not registered. So yeah, it's a real struggle. But I think the thing that the unions have going for them is that they've got a ton of members, right? Tens of thousands of members. They're spread all over the state. All those members have, brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and husbands and wives and kids that can sign these packets. So, they do have a bit of advantage in that regard, but it also is going to take them quite a bit of money to, if they need to hire signature gatherers, paid signature gatherers, which they said they're looking at doing, that costs money. And then once you get it on the ballot, you got to campaign for the thing. So it's not an easy task. And so, we'll be watching over the next, and oh, and I should have mentioned, it's on a pretty tight time frame too. I mean, basically from the day they start gathering signatures, which presumably is going to be Saturday or possibly Monday, they have 30 days to gather those signatures, so they've really got to hustle.
I guess good news for their side. There's a poll out, right? Apparently HB 267 is unpopular.
Yeah, this poll was done actually during the session when the legislature was considering the bill. And it was basically an 80-20 split that, people are not supportive of eliminating I can't remember exactly how they phrased the question off the top of my head, but they're not supportive of reducing labor unions' collective bargaining rights for public employees. And so, that 80-20 split, I think, is a good sign. But, that there's probably going to be other polling. I think that the labor unions are outdoing polling actually, in advance of this in advance of this effort. And the other thing I guess I should mention that the labor unions have going for them in this regard is they all have national affiliates. So if they do ultimately need funds for signature gathering or campaigning, they could draw on those. And one of the last times the referendum was actually used was in 2007. And in that one, the National Education Association, well, that referendum was the Utah Education Association trying to repeal the what then was the original vouchers bill. And it was the National Education Association was able to pump millions of dollars into that campaign. And so, it's they certainly have that asset or those pockets that they could potentially draw on if they need to spend some money.
I want to move to your story. You're talking about the legislature versus the judiciary. So apparently, the headline: two bills aimed at making it easier to vote Utah judges off the bench are dead for now. Tell me about these proposals. And I guess nothing's ever truly dead until midnight tonight, right? But it looks like it's dead for now.
I think this one you can probably, put a pin in it. It's there. So we talked before on the program about the big fight between the legislature and the judiciary. The legislature was mad about the courts for a number of rulings, whether it's, abortion ruling or the transgender sports ruling or the ballot initiative rulings last year that ended up knocking that constitutional amendment off the ballot. And so there was this fight brewing even before the session started about what the legislature was going to do to kind of crack down on the judiciary. And there were a ton of bills that were introduced and ultimately the courts pushed back on it. I think last time I was on, we talked about how the courts were pushing back on some of those bills and saying they were a bad idea. I think Justice Peterson had the quote of the year, saying that, we're just asking to punch us in the stomach and not face and tell them we'll be fine with that. So they pushed back on that pretty hard. Ultimately, what they decided to do, what they met with leadership, had discussions that both sides said were constructive, and came to an agreement that one of the bills they're not going to oppose, that's the bill that would let the governor appoint the Chief Justice, and the Senate confirm the Chief Justice, and then the Chief Justice would have to be reappointed every 4 years. So every 4 years, potentially the Chief Justice would have to go to the legislature and, ask for his or her job again. And that gives the legislature some leverage over whether or not to, reconfirm the Chief Justice if they don't like something that the courts are doing. So they're not going to oppose that one. That one is moving through the process. I believe last I checked, that one was in the House. It probably will pass today. It is a priority for the Senate leadership, so I think that one's going to pass. Two other bills that would have impacted judicial retention process are not going to be passing this year. One of those is Representative Carrie Ann Lisenby's bill that would have created this legislative committee to review judges who are up for retention. Judges go up for on the ballot every 6 years for a retention election. This would have created a legislative committee that could have called the judge in, or taken public comment on certain judges that they choose to do an investigation on, and then put on the ballot whether the legislative committee believes that that judge should or should not be retained, which is pretty unusual. I mean, if you think about it, when you get your ballot, it would have, Tom Williams, and then legislative committee recommends you be retained because you're a great judge. But they could also recommend you not be retained. So that bill, they've decided to shelve this year, which is a fairly big deal, but it also they can revisit that next year because the next judicial retention election isn't until 2026. So they have a little bit more time on that one. One other bill that is not going to pass this year was a bill that Jason Kyle was sponsoring. And that would have raised the required target or threshold for judges to be retained from 50%, like it has been for since retention elections started, up to two-thirds. They would have to get above two-thirds in order to be retained. And his argument on that was, well, most of the judges are getting between around 70% anyway, so really this isn't going to matter. But the judges thought, well, if we're having to go before this judicial retention committee and get two-thirds and jump through these hoops with the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission that is already doing these judicial reviews, they think it might be more difficult for them to get and retain qualified judges. It's a much less attractive job in that respect. So the legislature agreed not to run that one this year. Again, they can revisit it next year. And since there's no judicial retention elections until 2026, they could come back and do that later.
Let's move to I guess a top priority for Governor Cox, a new development agency or new powers for the governor. That one appears to have been killed, you say as well.
Yeah, that one is dead now. The this would have been the Beehive Development Agency, and this came out pretty late in the session, and it came out in a pretty, I guess, I don't know, sweeping form. But what the how this was explained was that that this office in the governor's Office of Economic Opportunity would have the sort of coordinating between all of the different authorities that have been created, the Military Installation Development Authority, the Bear Park Authority, the Point, Inland Port Authority, all of these different authorities. It would be coordinating with those, and also coordinating the other tax incentives that the state has to offer to lure large economic projects to the state. Senator Cullimore said maybe this is a nuclear power plant, or maybe this is a major manufacturing facility. But that would be sort of the point of contact for these businesses that want to do a large project like that. The bill got a lot of blowback from conservatives and just across the political spectrum. I mean, people from the Eagle Forum were testifying that this was a power grab by the governor. I should note that the original form of this didn't require any approval or buy-in from the city or county, although the cities and counties had to cooperate with it by providing police, sewer, fire, roads, all of these things that the development would need. And the agency would be able to take 70 up to 75% of the taxes created in that project area that they designate to sort of subsidize the projects or build infrastructure for the projects. And so they got big pushback from the cities and counties. They got big pushback from the conservative faction who said, we don't need more centralized planning. It got pushback from conservation groups who said, oh, this is a way to backdoor some big big projects that would have environmental impacts. And so they ended up watering it down considerably, right? They ended up requiring the cities to be give their consent and create and broaden the oversight a little bit. But at the end of the day, it just couldn't get enough support. I think there was enough bad blood created by the initial version and enough opposition created that they couldn't get enough support, and it ended up dying in the Senate without a vote. So they will. Senator Colin Moore, the sponsor of the bill, said they will be discussing it during the interim and potentially bringing it back next year, but for this session, that one's dead.
I would like to treat just one more story quickly here. I know we have to let you go. The headline: should churches have to pay to maintain city roads? Apparently, House and City have House and Senate have competing bills. Of course, this is a central rule, right? Churches don't pay taxes, right? So, where is this debate coming from? Let's see, it looks like you're muted, Robert.
Sorry about
There we
that.
go.
So you are correct. I mean, it is policy nationally and locally that churches can't be taxed. But there are a dozen cities that charge what they call transportation utility fees. These are fees that are sort of impact fees for roads to build and maintain roads. And the idea being that the Supreme Court ruled a couple years ago in a Pleasant Grove case that impact fees like this are not taxes. If the fee is directly tied, is collected for a specific purpose and then used for that purpose, that's an impact fee, not a tax. And so the argument then is, well, should we make an exemption for, meeting houses? And if we do make an exemption, how broad should that be? I mean, that's sort of the point of contention right now. The House passed a bill that didn't make any exemptions. It just put some guidelines in place that cities have to do, a study on what that particular parcel of property's impact is. Because obviously a big shopping mall is going to have more impact than my house, so they have to cap there has to be some of that taken into consideration. And it has to be, used for the purpose of building and maintaining roads. They're just putting some guidelines in place. But there's no exemption for churches in the version that the House passed. There's a version in the Senate that was sponsored by Senator Brady Brammer that would have given churches a blanket exemption. They would be completely exempt, whether that property is, a ward house or stake center or administrative building or, potentially City Creek shopping mall. So that one, the House, like I said, the House passed the version without the exemption. The Senate put in a somewhat narrower exemption that was the church wanted the blanket exemption, but the Brammer passed a bill, 1514, that gives them a more limited exemption that would just exempt ward houses, administrative offices, and welfare centers. And to be clear, I should be clear, this is not just for the LDS Church. It applies to all churches equally. But the LDS Church, being one of the biggest landowners, if not the biggest landowner in the state, is, particularly impacted by this. So the Brammer bill with a small exemption passed passed the Senate, went over to the House, and it's sitting over there. The House had already considered that narrower exemption and voted it down before it passed the one without an exemption. So it's just kind of sitting over there, and we'll find out today where that one goes. But obviously, a big potential impact for the church. They're both Senator Brammer and Senate President Stuart Adams said that, you know, if they don't pass anything, then the church could go to court and sue over this. You know, ask, even though the Supreme Court had ruled recently on this, they could sue again and try to, you know, try to get that overturned. And so there's, you know, it's fairly high stakes. There's a lot of money on the line. There's this potential litigation on the line, and there's this showdown between the House and Senate on if they want to give an exemption, and if they do give an exemption, what that's going to look like. And that one's going to be playing out by midnight tonight.
All right, yeah, the last day of the legislature, you'll be busy. Thanks for taking some time to be with us right now, Robert Gerke. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be talking with Open Lands reporter Anastasia Huffam in the next segment. Here's the headline. They used to run Utah's national parks. They say President Trump's mass firings are a really big deal. We'll have more following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And we turn next to Salt Lake Tribune Open Lands reporter Anastasia Huffam. Anastasia, thanks so much.
Of course.
So, yeah, it's big news. We've seen the protests in the national parks, not only Utah, but around the country. Of course, this is the part of, I guess, attempted deficiencies, right? Layoffs, belt tightening on the federal level from President Trump and from Elon Musk. And so we're going to talk about the national parks. You talked with some former superintendents. I do know from my own experience and our reporters' experiences, current superintendents don't want to talk. So you talked to former superintendents. What are they saying?
Yeah, as you said, you know, the news about a lot of National Park Service employees getting laid off, you know, has been national news. So I tried to take a closer look as to what that would actually mean for Utah. A couple of weeks ago, I was able to confirm that at least 17 National Park Service employees have been fired from Utah National Parks. Again, that number has been hard to nail down because, as you said, there seems to be a pretty firm clampdown on communications about the firings from the agencies themselves. We've reached out to the National Park Service for comment on these kind of layoffs. And, you know, what they said to us is that they are, quote, hiring seasonal workers to continue enhancing the visitor experience, and that they are, quote, focused on ensuring that every visitor has the chance to explore and connect with these incredible iconic spaces. So, again, haven't got a lot of information from them. So, as you said, we've reached out to some former superintendents. We talked to a former superintendent of Bryce Canyon National Park, of Arches and Canyonlands National Parks, and of Capitol Reef National Park. So, and what they said, I mean, pretty much the thesis was that the parks are in trouble, that these layoffs are going to have a really big impact in a lot of different ways. Yes, the kind of front-facing ways that you might think of first, like bathrooms and long lines and struggles with parking, but also in a lot bigger, more kind of deeper under the surface ways.
So 17 spread over what I'm familiar with, the Mighty Five, but I don't know if we have other places. You know, you could say it doesn't seem like that much, one or two per park kind of thing. But these former superintendents are saying that any cuts will have a ripple effect.
Yeah, that's something we really specifically asked the superintendents about was, you know, this idea of, well, if it's only one or two or three employees per park, you know, how much of a impact does that actually have? And what they all said was that, you know, there are no kind of like doubled, there are no employees performing duplicate roles, if that makes sense. So if one employee is fired, that means that their entire role goes away. And it, of course, depends on, you know, what kinds of people were fired, what positions they were, which, again, is information we've not been able to get. But, you know, for example, we talked to Linda Mazu, who used to be the superintendent for Bryce Canyon National Park, and she described a really scary situation in 2020 where there was a lost hiker in Bryce Canyon National Park, and it was a three-day search to try to find him. And it was a really all hands on deck situation is how she described it. You know, you had people from, of course, the Park Service, but also volunteers and people from Garfield County, where the park is, and local fire departments. And she said, you know, like if you have one or two or three fewer people to look out for that person, that's a lesser chance that that person is found. So she really described it as far as, the impact on public safety, which I thought was really important. But, there's also concerns about, people, these park rangers who specialize in interpretive and educational roles, who are, helping your kid become a junior ranger, or who are telling you about archaeological and cultural sites and how to best respect them, and how those might be at risk now that there aren't people around to enforce those rules and offer that kind of knowledge that you might not have if you are visiting one of Utah's national parks for the first time.
So one of the superintendents, I think, was talking specifically about Capitol Reef, was quite concerned about if you have fewer eyes and ears, right? Potentially protecting cultural resources. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. So this was Sue Fritzky, who used to be the superintendent for Capitol Reef. And she, was talking about how the park is home to, thousands of years of human habitation, different indigenous groups coming through the area, and also, pioneer groups coming through the area over, again, thousands of years. And the park is home to a lot of really important sites, like petroglyphs, that things of that nature. And she talked to me a little bit about how in 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic was at its peak, there weren't as many park rangers around the national parks for, pandemic related reasons, and they saw an uptick in the number of cultural sites that had graffiti on them or were otherwise degraded. And she said, she fears that that's going to happen again. If there are fewer eyes on people, if fewer eyes and ears is what she said, then that's fewer people who can protect those really important cultural resources. And that people might unfortunately take those fewer eyes and ears as license to kind of act however they want, with regard to these artifacts. So yeah, that's definitely a concern. And she said that was, really important to think about when it's when we're talking about all of these layoffs.
Well, to follow up on the safety, aren't the county sheriffs involved here? Couldn't they pick up some of that slack?
Yeah, absolutely. But that is not necessarily, a foolproof plan, I guess, is what I would say. I think something that Walt Dabney, who was the superintendent of Arches and Canyonlands National Park, back in the 1990s, he said, people are coming into Arches and Canyonlands, for example, in southeastern Utah, and that's a really harsh environment. There are these tall cliffs, it's a desert, and if you're unfamiliar with the heat or the water, the water that you might need to carry out on your hike, then you're going to be in a really difficult situation. And yeah, of course, you can, of course, there are local fire departments and local county sheriffs who are able to help out, but that means it's more of a burden for them, and they don't necessarily have the same funding resources as the federal government, or as the federal government used to have. And it's also important, Walt Dabney said that these county deputies don't often have the climbing or emergency medical training that park rangers are given. So there are, there's a definitely concern that if you're in a pinch, and you're in a really remote, hard to access place, a person who might have just been fired from the National Park Service may have had the knowledge to come save you quicker, faster, when time really is of the essence. Then, of course, the county sheriffs, who of course have wonderful training and are, totally passionate about their jobs and public safety and search and rescue, they might just not have the same training that those National Park Service employees had. So again, it just means that there are fewer people with less, and potentially just less expertise out there, when it comes to public safety situations in Utah's national parks.
I want to have you talk a little bit more about seasonal workers. Quite a few seasonal workers come in. Visitorship really ramps up right about now, right, in Utah.
It
It's
does.
conflicting information about what the government's gonna do with seasonal workers.
Yeah, it's been really confusing to nail down for not only reporters, but also for the people who are in fact employed by the National Park Service. Earlier this year, the Park Service said they would not be hiring 5,000 seasonal workers. And again, kind of as you said, Tom, seasonal workers really bolster the park's permanent workforce during the busy seasons, like spring and summer. So yeah, earlier this year, the Park Service said, hey, we're not going to hire 5,000 of those people Then the Department of the Interior said, just kidding, we are going to hire those 5,000 people, but then fired 1,000 permanent park employees. And then, and this was just like a week and a half ago, in its latest memo, the Park Service said it would hire up to 7,700 seasonal workers in 2025, which is more than usual. So it's just been a lot of back and forth. You know, when are these seasonal employees coming? How many are coming? And something that Sue Fritzky and Linda Mazzu, the former superintendents of Capitol Reef and Bryce Canyon National Parks, respectively, said was, you know, usually these people should have already been onboarded, hired, you know, ready to go in February so that they could get out to their park locations and start training. Because even if you were a seasonal employee at another national park somewhere else in the country, you know, national parks are totally unique, and the different jobs that a seasonal employee might have to do at, you know, one park, say in Alaska, is not necessarily the same as what they would have to do at a park here in Utah. So they both really spoke to the fact that we're really behind in training up these seasonal workers so that they are able to assist visitors in the ways that they're often needed to, like with parking or with questions or with public safety. They're just really behind. And as you noted, Tom, you know, what we know from past visitation numbers is that traffic to Utah's national parks really ramps up in March. You know, we're talking tripling the numbers from February to March. So people are headed here for spring break. Utah's national parks get busier earlier than a lot of other national parks because we are in a warmer area, and you can our parks are just like ready for our hikes are open, our trails are cleared earlier than maybe other parks. So yeah, there's and you know, spring break is now, and we don't necessarily have the workers ready and trained up to help with that new onslaught of visitors, is what the superintendent said.
Finally, in the story, Anastasia, these former superintendents are, pointed out. You point out in your story, the visitors to the national parks in Utah pour millions and millions of dollars into the local economies. I get, for now, visitorship, I think, is good. We assume it, same numbers of people will be coming. These superintendents worry that maybe the experience gets degraded with fewer workers, and that affects the visitorship.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a big concern that if there aren't people to help with parking or to clean restrooms or to mitigate long lines or to help in search and rescue operations, that people are not going to want to come to national parks. Or people will come and have a really horrible experience and then not come again. And you know, it's kind of hard to say because we don't exactly know how this is going to pan out yet. As we said, we're kind of at the start of the busy season. But all of these visitors who come to Utah's national parks, they also stay in hotels near them. They rent gear. They contract with or they work with some guides to go on different adventures in these parks. They also, you know, eat at restaurants and shop in local shops. So if that visitation does go down, that means the whole economies are going to be really impacted. And again, we don't really know how this is going to pan out yet. But what we do know is that these workers who have been fired, you know, they're also members of the community where the park is. They've been contributing to that community, not only working for the parks, but you know, they've been buying groceries or they've been going to those same shops. And now that they are no longer have a job, you know, a lot of them are on unemployment, which also affects these local economies. So instead of, you know, I'll read a quote from Sue Fritzky, who is the superintendent of Capitol Reef. She said, quote, instead of being gainfully employed and participating in the community, they're going to be on unemployment, end quote. And she said, you know, that has a real impact on the economy. So yeah, I think definitely something to keep an eye on, or that we'll be keeping an eye on for the next couple of months, is how does this impact Utah's local economies, and how do these visitation numbers change based on the experience that visitors have to these parks?
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune Open Lands reporter Anastasia Huffam. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to head toward another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. And here's the headline we're talking about the next segment. Heber City wants to reimagine itself like Vernal once did to welcome tourists. Locals ask, what about us? We'll be talking with emerging news reporter Brock Marchant. That's coming up following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune emerging news reporter Brock Marchant. Brock, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me.
This is a very interesting story, you know, just in and of itself, but also particularly to me because Vernal is my hometown and Heber City is halfway from here to Vernal. So I've been through Heber hundreds of times. Maybe not in the way that Heber City would like me to be, although I did, you know, spend some money there briefly. So the headline, Heber City wants to reimagine itself like Vernal once did to welcome tourists. Locals ask, what about us? So what is Heber wanting to do?
Yeah, so like many communities in Utah right now, Heber City is looking toward downtown redevelopment and downtown projects that would allow the kind of public infrastructure and public spaces to foster an area where they could grow a stronger tax base through tourism dollars. You know, maybe a parking garage so people can walk to local businesses downtown rather than needing to park there. Maybe more pedestrian-friendly spaces. Things of that nature that allow it to be a more open place for, like we've talked about a little bit, visitors, but also for locals to go to, you know, for those local shops and that spending and those tax dollars.
So tell me what's happening right now. I guess Thursday evenings, you're right, are special, especially in the summer. They have some nice events.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if that's happening right now, but in Heber City, on Thursday evenings at their park right next to their main street, they will have these big events, Heber Market on Main, where they'll have a lot of vendors, a lot of food, and the community will come together. A lot of people attended each week. I had the opportunity to a few times over this last summer, and a lot of city leaders will point to it and kind of use it, and other community members as well, to say, hey, we have interest here to have these community spaces, to have this stronger downtown, to have these kinds of gatherings, and people will come if we have it for them. So it kind of goes to show why, well, part of the reason they're looking into these developments, into looking into how we can foster these public spaces in these kinds of events. So that's kind of, yeah, that's what's happening Thursday nights there. And that plays into, again, this downtown plan that they're working toward. And last year, and I mean, last year was kind of, they had a lot of goals for this, but also, the planning has gone on for years before, but they were looking toward a funding mechanism called a community reinvestment agency and asking other local taxing entities to support that. And the idea is entities like Wasatch County and Wasatch County School District, who were both key players, would receive a set amount of property tax dollars from their downtown area where they're currently collecting that revenue. But should tax increase with that redevelopment, that increment, you know, that increase would go toward the CRA projects. They ran into a bit of, I guess you could call it a roadblock, where neither Wasatch County nor Wasatch County School District kind of came on board onto this funding mechanism that by the end of last year, as Heber City was hoping.
What do opponents to this plan say? Why are they concerned?
So a lot of locals, well, number one, a lot of people see it as that they're concerned. Does this mean we're going to be using school district dollars, you know, education dollars, or even county dollars meant for other projects, other things toward this downtown redevelopment? And Heber City is really pushed to educate and to try to make sure people understand that it's what goes back into the reinvestment is the increment, you know, any raises it from that tax base that currently exists for those entities in that area. And other people are concerned with, well, if we have this downtown, if we foster these projects that are going to be inviting to tourism, are we going to be doing that to the expense of locals, you know, who miss maybe the small town Heber City feel that they knew, you know, years ago? Are we going to be inviting projects that are going to further push that away?
So at a certain point, Heber City had the Vernal city manager come and talk about a project that Vernal's been doing to kind of tout what can be done. Tell me what's happened in Vernal.
Absolutely. So similar to Heber City, Vernal was concerned about their downtown for slightly different reasons. But the Vernal city manager mentioned a few years ago they were looking at their downtown taxable value and realizing not only was it not increasing in ways that they would want it to, but it was decreasing. He noted like 20 empty storefronts in the downtown core area, and he found that to be pretty problematic. So in a similar way as Heber City's intending to do, they launched a community reinvestment agency project to help restore those empty storefronts, to help revitalize their downtown, bring back the more energetic and historical vibe of the place, if you will, to continue bringing in tourists, as well as just establishing a more active downtown community.
I guess in Vernal, maybe it's a little different. The problem was maybe a little more apparent, all these abandoned storefronts, right? And you could actually really see it viscerally. I think that's because the big box stores came on the west side of town and took business away from Vernal. So this apparently has been successful. There's many fewer vacant buildings, et cetera.
Yeah, it has been. The Vernal city manager, Quinn Bennion, said he's seen those values not only make up for what they lost, but also increase further than he expected. He's seen a lot of revitalization, a lot of businesses downtown that he didn't think would have really survived otherwise. So he definitely went and supported Heber City in their project, trying to convince county leaders and others within the community that it's definitely worth the investment. That it can make a difference for a community, and it's worth putting those dollars into.
One more thing on Vernal that really struck me, is this may only interest me because I'm from Vernal, that a lot of these businesses use some of this money to establish entrances in the back of their building away from Main Street, because Main Street's gotten so busy.
Yeah, it was interesting the way Vernal approached this and the way Heber City did were a little bit different, where Heber City's CRA projects were mainly going to be focused on public infrastructure, and Vernal turned largely toward, well, we're going to turn this into grants, so we're going to be able to fund a large part of local businesses if they want to improve their building, if they want to improve the facade, the entrances. So it's definitely interesting the way different business owners approached it, and what Vernal City has seen in the past few years, given this grant funding and what it's allowed people to do.
Now, the Heber City manager told you they're still hoping to go ahead. The lack of some of these entities coming on board will just slow down the project.
Yeah. He essentially said they're looking into grant funding, how they can leverage that. They're still looking to have those conversations with those other taxing entities in hopes of that downtown project and getting funding for that. And even though, like you mentioned, these situations are different, where Vernal's downtown was falling in taxable value, and maybe Heber City's situation isn't quite so dire as that, or at least quite as apparent. But he talked about how, well, we don't have a large, or he said they don't have a large economic, engine right now in Heber City. He's hoping that through this project, through that downtown revitalization, they can kind of create that economic engine through tax dollars that could come through tourism. So he's still hopeful, even if it was a bit of a setback that other entities didn't come aboard.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to say about the story?
I think we covered the bases of it. It really is interesting watching the city try to revitalize their downtown, try to create these public projects and invite more people in with the basis of let's get more tax funds, let's get more places where people can gather and have these events, and to see people's concerns that you otherwise might not think about, of losing historic small town Heber or wondering where exactly the tax dollars are going to be coming from. It's definitely created a situation that has it has a lot of potential. It has a lot of hopes, like we've talked about, and it has a lot of concerns from residents who either wouldn't love tourism in their town or are concerned or don't quite understand how the tax funding mechanism would work.
I think these debates are happening in many towns across Utah. One thing I'd like to highlight before we close here, from your story just jumped out at me, that the power of one individual. Apparently these Thursday nights, the summer Thursday night events, started because a local DJ got tired of traveling to Park City to DJ events. He wanted something in his hometown. That's how it started.
Yeah, that's what I heard a while ago from a longtime sponsor of, what the event was back then. And I believe they still are a sponsor of what it's become today. But it definitely, those Thursday evenings definitely do show if you have these downtown areas, if you have the infrastructure to bring people in, to provide an opportunity for them to dine, to socialize, to do something fun in the downtown, they'll come. People from the community as well as people outside. And it really is, it's interesting to see this park that for most evenings is, maybe has some kids playing on the playground equipment or maybe has a few families out for a stroll, but it really becomes a very social and a very central point of Heber City. So it's pretty dramatic, seeing that difference and seeing what exactly this downtown revitalization project could foster.
Well, emerging news reporter Brock Marchand's been telling us about this. Brock, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
If we had time, we're going to talk a little bit about this headline. Here's how Utah's ICE detainment process works and what's changed, immigration experts say. That's Brock's story from last week. We'll just point you to that. Some interesting information there about how some changes to the ICE detainment process. That's also in Spanish as well on the sltrib.com website. Well, it's time for our underplayed stories of the week, and we'll start with Anastasia Huffam. What's your underplayed story of the week?
I would love to up a story from Addie Baird. She's been following really closely the bill about banning pride flags from Utah schools and government buildings. And that bill has now headed to the governor. So if you are wanting to, kind of know the latest on all of that and kind of the back and forth going on about that bill, definitely check out that story on our website.
All right, sltrib.com for that and all these stories. Brock Marchand, what's your underplayed story of the week?
One that just published this morning that I find really interesting is from Peggy Fletcher Steck. So, excuse me, Peggy Fletcher. Oh, I cannot speak this morning. Peggy Fletcher Stack, and it is as U.S. debates the status of refugees, LDS Church holds up its most famous one. I think that's a pretty interesting read in context of everything that's happening right now nationally.
Yeah, we're talking about Elder Dieter F. Uchtdorf, who's from Germany and was a child in World War II. Yeah, he was a refugee, I think, at least twice. Interesting story. Check that out at sltrib.com as well. Early in the program, we talked with political reporter Robert Gerke. Our thanks to him. We've been talking today with Open Lands reporter Anastasia Huffam. Anastasia, thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you. We've been talking with emerging news reporter Brock Marchand as well. Brock, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. And you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you join me again next time.